In a year characterized by economic dislocation, ecological catastrophe, Western military interventions, and the specter of another Middle East war, what comprised the major news stories of 2013? What were the significant events and developments ignored or even censored by mainstream media? What were the major stories of the past year affecting the world's indigenous peoples? And why is it that critical headlines relating to GMOs, indigenous resistance struggles, Western support for terrorist groups, nuclear pollution from Fukushima, and secretive trade agreements like the TPP get systematically ignored by media in the first place? As we start the new year, the Global Research News Hour will review these subjects with John Aniwanika Shirto of Intercontinental Cry magazine, Dr. Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored, and Professor Michelle Chosadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization. On this week's program, 2013, a review of the most censored stories of the year. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 3rd, 2014. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Over 12 years into the so-called Global War on Terror, the United States appears to be striking terror into the hearts of the rest of the world. In their annual end-of-year survey, Wind Gallup International found that the United States is considered the number one greatest threat to peace in the world today by people across the globe. The BBC explains that the U.S. was deemed a threat by geopolitical allies as well as foes, including a significant portion of U.S. society. Predictable in some areas, the Middle East and North America, but less so in others, Eastern Europe's 32% figure may be heavily influenced by Russia and Ukraine, but across most of Western Europe, there are also lots of figures in the high teens. That's from the article, Greatest Threat to World Peace, The United States of America, by Sarah Lazar, posted January 1st, originally appearing at commondreams.org. Last June, Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian revealed that Edward Snowden was the NSA insider behind one of the most significant leaks in U.S. political history. Snowden explained his motivations through Greenwald by saying, quote, "There are more important things than money. Harming people isn't my goal." Unquote. Such altruistic motivations were welcome news at the time, have come into question recently given that only a tiny fraction of the documents have been released nearly a year after Snowden started working with Greenwald. Perhaps more importantly, billionaire Pierre Omidyar is funding Greenwald's slow release of those documents. It is worth noting that Omidyar's PayPal Corporation has links to the NSA. That's from the article, Inconsistencies and Unanswered Questions, The Risks of Trusting the Snowden Story, by Kevin Ryan, posted January 1st, originally published at digwithin.net. The State of Israel is ready for another war in Gaza, following incidents in the Israeli-Gaza borders where it claims that numerous rockets were fired from the Gaza by terrorist groups, according to the Times of Israel. Israel will launch strikes deep into Gaza if new peace talks fail when the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who is scheduled to arrive this week. As tensions rise in the Middle East with Iran's nuclear program and the continuing civil war in Syria, and now Lebanon's southern border with Hezbollah's military capabilities, Israel is only interested in weakening Gaza's militants. I expect the next incursion into Gaza will be more severe, resulting in more Palestinian and Israeli casualties. Israel says it is defending their citizens, but aren't the Palestinians defending their future from a state that seeks to dominate them? That's from the article, Israel Ready to Invade Gaza. Planned attack would exact a heavy toll, by Timothy Alexander Guzman, posted January 1st, originally published at Silent Crow News. Not only have democratic elections failed to enhance the quality of life and standard of living in numerous African countries and elsewhere, Kenya is a country in which democratic elections in December 2007 unleashed horrendous inter-ethnic slaughter and violent destabilization in a country that had hitherto been a model of stability and economic and social development for Africa and the developing world. How can the sudden eruption of such clan and tribal warfare be explained in a country that had, for decades, not undergone such violent inter-ethnic conflict and destabilization? Recently, a highly placed diplomatic source accredited to the United Nations observed a pattern emerging in African countries where Western NGOs with links to U.S. intelligence were based and operating. Previously non-existent inter-ethnic violence suddenly erupted, and this phenomenon was occurring in even the most stable countries. One of these Western NGOs in particular was based and operating in Kenya since 2003, a full 4 years before the sudden eruption of inter-ethnic warfare and violent destabilization that followed the December 2007 democratic elections. Recalling that Russian President Putin prohibited U.S. aid and particular Western NGOs from operating in Russia, one can only conclude that he was trying to spare Russia from the fate observed in too many African countries and elsewhere. That's from the article, The Destabilization of Africa, A Machiavellian Intrigue of Colossal Proportions, by Carla Shea, posted January 1st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The online magazine Intercontinental Cry provides a unique service to readers in that it regularly reports on indigenous people's struggles across the planet with local, municipal, and federal governments, as well as corporations, private interest groups, police and military forces, paramilitary organizations, and international institutions like the World Bank. IC frequently picks up on stories missed by other media, including the independent media. John Anewanika Shirto is the driving force behind Intercontinental Cry. He's an internationally recognized editor and publisher and award-winning journalist. He's based in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and he's here to talk about the year 2013 in Indigenous news and struggle, some of the stories missed by other media, and how things are looking moving forward. So, John Shirto, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thanks for the intro, and Happy New Year to you and to all our listeners as well.
You wrote an article just a few days ago called Neglected and Ignored, 10 Major Stories That Should Have Made More Headlines in 2013. Do you want to talk about a few of those stories?
Yes. One of the most disturbing, actually, I could probably say that 1,000 times here, but is the situation with human safaris in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, which is a union territory of India. And
that's
so
to the east of India.
Yeah, in the Bay of Bengal.
Okay.
And the situation there has been going on for quite some time now, where one of the indigenous peoples on the island, known as the Jarawa people, are being treated like zoo animals by tourists, individuals from Britain and from India and elsewhere, actually pay money to go and visit the Jarawa and treat them essentially like monkeys at a zoo, where people give food and promises of clothing or even some kind of knickknack in exchange for the Jarawa to perform for them. You know, like the fact that this doesn't get much coverage in North America is remarkably disturbing. And it does actually get a lot of attention in India nowadays and in the UK, thanks to Survival International, who has a dedicated campaign to this. And there was some positive developments in 2013, where the courts were pressured into banning tourists from this major road that the tourists and tourist industry uses to access the Jarawa territory. But then, just 4 months, 3 months after this great ruling came down, the courts reversed the decision, opened up the road again, giving everybody free access to go meet the Jarawa. And even more disturbing, the court point blank asked authorities on the island if they wanted to assimilate the Jarawa people. And this has been an issue for quite some time now. Fortunately, the authorities on the island have an explicit policy or law that dictates that they won't try to assimilate them. But the fact that the court, hey, you want to assimilate these people, is just shocking. But even more shocking, again, is the fact that nobody in North America covered this. There was a video uploaded online to the Observer and reposted on the Guardian, which showed just how the Jarawa are being treated. There's corrupt police officers who are taking payments and taking these people to go meet the Jarawa. Women and children being pressured into performing like this is one of the most shocking and degrading examples of colonialism in the world today. And the fact that nobody is covering this in North America is beyond bizarre. This should be a priority for everybody. Just because it's so disturbing.
I noticed another story has to do with an anti-tribal sovereignty group, CIRA.
Yeah, Citizens for Equal Rights Alliance. And this too, the fact that this received no attention in North America is perhaps even more disturbing. This organization, CIRA, is the most prominent quote-unquote anti-Indian organization in the United States. And they just organized 4 major conferences in Massachusetts, New York, California, and Washington, dedicated to teaching American citizens how to take down tribal governments. When we talk about CIRA, we're not talking about a couple Gary McHales sitting on their soapbox. We're talking about a network of 30,000 people, a heavily well-funded organization that's sponsored openly and proudly by the Tea Party, who has ties to the Wise Use Movement, which is a massive private property rights anti-environmentalist organization in the U.S. that goes back to the 80s and 90s. Some of their members, such as a guy named Skip Richards, who's a private property rights activist in Bellingham, Washington, who's known for recruiting Christian patriot militias. So this is who we're talking about, and these people just organized 4 major conferences in the U.S., and nobody noticed. Mm-hmm. Other than IC, the only attention that this really received was from the Cascadia Weekly and the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who also published an in-depth piece on the conference and just who these people are. But it's very disturbing that these people were just able to take their first steps in building a massive anti-tribal sovereignty movement in the U.S. And where was Occupy? Never mind the media. I understand why the mainstream media didn't cover this, because they don't care, or maybe they want it to go forward. I don't know. But nobody in the grassroots paid attention. The UME themselves organized a protest with a few allies under the Idle No More banner, but it just never got attention. And even now, they're probably, you know, organizing a 10-year strategic plan to take on, you know, water rights and fishing rights, specifically in those regions that I mentioned, California, Washington, New York, and Massachusetts, as well as gambling and, you know, any kind of tribal strength in the region. And nobody else is, and, you know, without challenge, without anybody saying anything. Yeah, it's very disturbing to me, you know, and these people are going to continue mobilizing with their money, with their massive support from the entire spectrum of the right wing. And if, you know, if there's not going to be any resistance to this, well, then, you know, the results are going to be obvious. Jay Tabor, who I mentioned earlier, who's written extensively about this and who's been researching the likes of the Wise Use Movement and, you know, Christian patriot militarism and domestic terrorism in the U.S. For at least 20 years, refers to CIRA as the Ku Klux Klan of Indian country.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, that sort of a KKK kind of
the ethic, yeah. The plan, and they are actively promoting, fomenting anti-Native sentiment in the U.S. That's the underlying layer of their, above this other layer that they're promoting of benevolence and righteousness, which is, you know, part of their plan.
You also wrote a piece that talked about 25 stories of resilience that also are not getting enough attention. Just sort of maybe put a more positive spin on the conversation. Is there a story or two that you'd like to bring up?
Well, certainly. Well, you know, like I said, like it's not just the intractable situations or the, you know, dangerous developments that don't get much attention. There's also a lot of positive news and, you know, assertions of authority, reclamations of land, outstanding acts of resistance, you know, that tend to slip by very often, unfortunately. And I think one strong set of examples are the efforts of a few First Nations in Canada. One thing I have noticed over the last 10 years is that when that Indigenous peoples, particularly in South and Central America and also in Southeast Asia, draw a specific line, you know, telling corporations to get off their territory or we're going to throw you off, you know, they assert their traditional authority, and in many cases it works. And I've always, you know, kind of hoped to see more of that in Canada. And now, fortunately, we are with the Wet'suwet'en, for example, who've been, you know, pushing against Enbridge and friends for quite some time now. And they've fortunately been getting a lot of grassroots attention and media attention as well. But two nations that didn't really get much attention last year was the Red Sucker Lake, who delivered a stop work order to Mega Precious Minerals in northern Manitoba. They stated at the time that the company was operating illegally in its traditional territory. You know, and the Matthias Kalom First Nation, also in Manitoba, issued a similar stop work order and eviction notice to Hudbay Mineral and Smelting, who's also quite notorious in Guatemala. And just those acts of authority, I find them to be outstandingly beautiful. It's my favorite kind of news to see, you know, nations not just turning to the court system or whatever to try and get, you know, some words on a piece of paper that can be changed anytime, but to, you know, go on the ground, you know, and challenge them. It's beautiful. And, you know, the Tahltan did something similar with Fortune Minerals, which ultimately, you know, resulted in a victory. The Tahltan, of course, defending Clapham Mountain inside the Sacred Headwaters, which is, you know, which the Fortune wanted to exploit. Another strong example of traditional assertions of authority were the Murawari peoples in Australia, who established an interim government, preparing for a new form of government that would a representative democracy. That would be where, you know, each of their ancestral family groups would coalesce into this, you know, national government. 27 other indigenous peoples around Australia also turned to the Marawi to learn from their example. So there's this massive nationhood movement group, movement growing in Australia. It received a fair amount of attention among activists in Australia, but, you know, beyond that, you know, it went by almost completely unnoticed again. Another strong assertion of authority just happened a couple of weeks ago in Papua New Guinea, where a Messie villager put up a gorgor at Nautilus's proposed Solawera 1 experimental seabed mining project. And under Papua New Guinea law, the gorgor has traditional power, and it basically forbids Nautilus from entering into the area. If Nautilus disobeys the order, the indigenous peoples, as far as they're concerned, have the right to destroy all of Nautilus's equipment, including their boats, you know, if they go into this this area that they've been prohibited from entering. Maybe it's no big deal to most people out there, but these kind of acts of strength are very important nowadays, you know, especially given the routine failure that indigenous peoples have faced in trying to work the court system and in trying to follow, you know, every single step and dodging every single challenge that governments and corporations and, you know, international institutions like the UN put in front of indigenous peoples, and degrading indigenous rights all along the way, and, you know, making every single nation on the planet settle for less. And, you know, opening up their doors to all sorts of other problems, like what we see with many of the laws that are court rulings that come down in Canada, where, you know, the courts will exploit them for the benefit of Canada at the expense of Indigenous peoples. It's routine practice. So to go out of the system and you know, work on the ground is a beautiful thing, and it's something that I hope to see more of in the years ahead.
John, now we were talking about, like, how so much of the media, including the alternative, independent, progressive media, just tend to ignore these sorts of stories. Do you have an explanation for the focus of much of the alternative media? I mean, we see Idle No More or Tar Sands. But why does it seem to be kind of stuck in those areas and not able to report more on these sorts of stories that you've been putting out now for over 9 years?
Well, one of the main reasons comes down to the political clout that NGOs have. The reason that the Belamonte Dam receives so much attention is primarily because of Amazon Watch, who's, you know, brilliant as far as you know, organizing goes. You know, they've really been able to bring this you know, to the international eye and keep it there. And with the tar sands, it's, you know, Indigenous Environmental Network and many others. But, you know, the media, actually the corporate media plays a major role there too. When I know none of us really like to applaud mainstream media, but the fact is they are still quite important. And, you know, you'll find that all the situations that they cover tend to also get the international attention as well, you know, grassroots attention especially, like what we saw with the Mi'kmaq. It wasn't just, you know, a few activists or the indigenous peoples themselves who were, you know, able to reach the international community. It was because of the coverage that the media was providing. Like, we see it, there's attacks going on, like what we saw with the Mi'kmaq, all over the place, and nobody pays attention to them, and, you know, they just go by, and that's the end of it. You know, the people are forgotten, the culture is forgotten, and that's just it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the attitude that publishers have, and the motives when it comes to mainstream media, non-mainstream media. You know, they don't have their priorities in check. They are not really thinking strategically about what they're doing. They're just, you know, trying to appeal to their readers, you know, they're designing content that's going to get attention, that's going to get more funds and more readers and whatever. They care about SEO more than they care about, you know, search engine optimization more than they care about, you know, actually telling the story, you know, actually covering the news, being a responsible journalist or a responsible publisher, especially those who live on the wings of being, you know, righteous human rights oriented, you know, investigative journals. And there's so many that just they don't really cover anything that's going on, especially when it comes to indigenous peoples, not just general human rights struggles. But and it's an unfortunate fact, you know, and it's one that I've been pushing for a long time. I was trying to convince, you know, Truth Out, for example, who has a big reader base, to start focusing more on indigenous peoples. You know, I wrote an analysis going over the fact that for every 40 articles that we publish at IC, they publish one concerning indigenous peoples. And, you know, as much as I can use that as bragging rights, it's also disturbing considering, you know, what we're talking about here. And hopefully media, the nonprofit media will start to take their work more seriously and start providing the real news that needs to be covered. Not just U.S. politics, but, you know, struggles around the world. We can only hope.
John, Intercontinental Cry is totally supported by its readers. It doesn't draw corporate or foundational or other sorts of supports like that. And I understand that we're in the last few days of a fundraiser for your organization. Do you want to talk about what you're hoping to accomplish with that fundraiser? And
yes, well, we're trying to expand our work significantly. One of the major things we're trying to do now is organize a new investigations arm at IC, so that we can start going to indigenous peoples on the ground and bring their stories to the international community's attention. And there's a lot of situations like the ones we've talked about here that don't get any media coverage at all, even less than what we've talked about. So we want to bring their stories, you know, to the table. And we're also planning to take on more writers and even possibly open an office here in Winnipeg so that we can, you know, really start getting serious with our work, more so than we already have. And so we're running a fundraiser right now to carry that work forward and also to, you know, just keep our work online. So if anybody wants to perhaps lend a hand, they can just visit us at intercontinentalcry.org, or they can run over to Indiegogo, which is where our campaign is, and do a search for IC Magazine, and they'll find our fundraiser there. I encourage people to visit our site, or to just, you know, go to any non-profit media site and you know, encourage people to encourage more coverage of indigenous peoples, and, you know, just support all the struggles that you come across, even if it's just a retweet. You know, it's no assertion of authority, but it helps to get the word out, and that's one of the most important things that people can do right now.
Well, John Aniwanika Shirto runs the website Intercontinental Cry. And he is also in the middle of a fundraiser. He's written articles and a number of different reports on the site. So if you'd like to contribute, feel free to go to that website, intercontinentalcry.org. John Shirto, thank you so much for agreeing to this interview and sharing your perspectives with us.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Since 1976, the media research program Project Censored has been vetting and compiling what they see as the top 25 most censored and underreported stories of the year. Dr. Andy Lee Roth is the associate director of Project Censored and one of the editors of this year's edition. He joins us now from his home in San Rafael in Northern California to tell us about his organization's top picks for most censored stories of the past year. How are you doing today, Andy Lee Roth?
Fine, Michael. Pleasure to join you.
Okay, could you maybe, as far as this year's stories are concerned, is there a particular set of themes or a pattern to the stories that we're getting this year?
I think there is kind of a coherent narrative that links together the news and analysis that we cover in Censored 2014. Mickey Huff, the director of the project, and I decided that the subtitle of this year's book would be Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. And one of the ideas there, fearless speech, comes from a set of lectures that the French philosopher Michel Foucault gave in Berkeley 30 years ago, right around this time 30 years ago, where he went back to the 5th century Athens notion of what we know today as free speech. And he said, Foucault's analysis, as he looked at kind of the etymology and the history and the archaeology of this term, was that it would be better described as fearless speech. Because, as he noted in those lectures, fearless speech always involved truth-telling at the expense of those who are in power and at some risk to the truth-teller. So fearless speech in fateful times, the second dimension of that is, of course, the fateful times dimension. And, you know, it's obvious to anyone who's been paying attention that we live in an era of unprecedented economic inequality. The environmental crisis with climate change is as great as any, perhaps, humankind has ever faced. The scourge of war is unfortunately omnipresent, even if we aren't always reminded of it by the corporate media. But the other aspect of the fateful times that Mickey and I wanted to address in this year's book is that the threat of disenchantment and cynicism. One aspect of this year's book that I'm really proud of, and it's manifest, for instance, in the foreword by Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine, is the idea that all the information and all the insight in the world won't matter if people become disenchanted or cynical about the world, about our communities, about our ability to act effectively in our communities and in the world. And so there's a real strong emphasis in this year's book on positive solutions and good news stories.
One of the stories, which is actually you list as your top pick, that seems to really connect with that theme is it's number one, Bradley Manning and the Failure of Corporate Media.
And I should begin by clarifying and apologizing that our book went to press before Bradley Manning announced the change of name to Chelsea Manning. So we aren't trying to do anything undermining there by using Bradley in the title of that story.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
I can kind of summarize in a nutshell the difference between the corporate media and the independent media. In September of 2013, Time magazine ran a story called Unchecked Aggression that was looking at the military security clearance system and how it's, quote, utterly and tragically broken. Time magazine, of course, one of the major corporate news weeklies here in the U.S. And in that story, there was a graphic that lined up four faces. There was Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter. There was Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. There was NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. And the fourth figure was Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis. So basically, lumped together were mass murderers and leakers, whistleblowers. That kind of coverage is obviously a form of propaganda to say who are these people and what company do they keep with. And so, by contrast, then, you had something like Al Jazeera saying, in response to Manning's assertion that he went to WikiLeaks in order to make the world a better place and that he hoped that leaking those documents, those documents would spark a domestic debate on the role of the U.S. military in foreign policy. And as Al Jazeera commented during the first part of Manning's trials, the lack of coverage raises questions whether the, as Al Jazeera calls it, the mainstream press was, quote, prepared to host the debate on U.S. interventions in foreign policy that Manning had in mind. And so with Manning, with Snowden, and with a number of other whistleblowers who we cover in this year's book, what we see is a consistent theme of, I think, it really is almost as simple as saying, shooting the messenger. And the irony in this case is that, of course, the Time magazines and the others who have been busy belittling the characters of people like Manning and Snowden are at the same time, without much introspection, using they're publishing stories based on the leaks from that data that Manning and Snowden have made available to the public.
Okay. I noticed there are a number of stories here relating to the money system. It seems like, for example, they talk about number six, billionaires' rising wealth intensifies poverty and inequality. The richest global 1% hide trillions in tax havens. Economic concerns. Would you like to share with us? Maybe there's a certain significant element.
Yeah, I mean, this is a major theme in our book, and it's actually in addition to the top 25, we put these stories together in what we call censored news clusters. And the cluster that holds all these economic stories is one written by James Tracy, and he called that cluster Plutocracy, Poverty, and Prosperity. And really, in some sense, what we're talking about is a plutocratic system here. And, of course, it made the corporate news in December of last year. President Obama told us that inequality was, quote, the defining challenge of our times. And yet the corporate media don't really give us complete information on these things. So each of those stories you mentioned, the richest global 1% are hiding trillions in tax havens, billionaires' rising wealth intensifies poverty and inequality, and another story, our number eight story, bank interests inflate global prices by 35% to 40%. Each of those stories are not being covered in the corporate media. They wouldn't be on our top 25 list if there was adequate coverage of these. So just to take one kind of concrete example, as Ellen Brown reports in her story on bank interest, that 35 to 40% of the cost of all the goods and services that we as consumers shoulder is an example of how wealth is systematically transferred from Main Street to Wall Street. So again, when you think about corporate media coverage, what we get is coverage of how the accrual of wealth is often the result of kind of scandal and wrongdoing. But what some of these stories show is that, you know, as they say about apps now, it's not a bug, it's a feature, right? We're talking about structural aspects of the society that are built to accrue wealth to those who are already wealthy at the expense of, the bottom 80, 90, whatever percent you want to talk about. This is a good place, too, though, to talk about there is a prosperity element to this. Because one of the things Ellen Brown talks about in her story on bank interest is there's a viable solution that we already have some evidence for how it works and for the fact that it does work. If banks weren't private corporate entities, if we had public banking, that interest would be available as a direct reimbursement to the public. It could be used for things like you could turn the banks into public utilities, and those profits could be redirected to the maintenance or the expansion of public assets. So this is a great example of what I was talking about a moment ago, where there is not only a problem that the corporate media aren't adequately addressing, but there are real viable solutions that aren't being covered either. And this is why we need so badly independent press to expand kind of the spectrum of what we know as citizens, as community members.
Another issue that I think it seems prominent in this crop of stories is that of food security. I know that Monsanto got a couple of stories in there, GMOs. There's another one called Fracking Our Food Supply. Do you want to talk about that whole issue of food security on the planet right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is a major issue. And in some ways, to me, one of the most crucial stories, you mentioned a couple of them in our list, but one of the most crucial is one by Nafees Ahmed from The Guardian on food riots and whether they would be the new normal. And this is really a big picture, kind of deep linkage sort of story that Nafees Ahmed put together based on research published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society by Paul and Anne Ehrlich. And it's looking at the links between economic inequality, debt, climate change, and our dependence on fossil fuel. These stories are treated as local and episodic. Nafees Ahmed's story, again, based on this scientific paper by Paul and Anne Ehrlich, is saying, look, what we've got here is the crux of a global phenomenon that's at its basis a climate change story. And by mid-century, we're facing the prospect that world crop yields could fall by as much as 20 to 40% because of climate change alone. And that's not even to get into then, as you note, and as we have stories, our number 18 story on fracking our food supply about groundwater contamination. And one of the things I like to point out to my sociology students is that for many, many important goods, there are alternatives. But so, for instance, for fossil fuels, we have green alternatives like wind and solar power. But for water, there is no substitute. We don't have an alternative for water. And so when we have fracking, hydraulic fracturing, its impact on our food supply and especially most fundamentally on our water security, these are serious stories, and the public needs to know more about them.
Okay. Now, we just have a couple of minutes left. There are plenty of very provocative stories here, a couple dealing with Israel, one on the epidemic of birth defects in Iraq, and Bush blocking an Iran nuclear deal, merchants of death and nuclear weapons. It's really a very rich selection. Some of these stories seem quite marginal, even within independent media. Do you have any thoughts about why they seem to be so...
I think that's often the kind of the $64,000 question, or adjusted for inflation, whatever the figure would be. And that's a question that we actually often raise in classrooms with the students who make such mighty contributions to the Project Censored book. But let's take just one. Number 9 on this year, the Icelanders vote to include the commons in their constitution. In October of 2012, the people of Iceland were asked to rethink their 1944 constitution, and one of the 6 proposed policy changes that was put to a kind of national plebiscite was, do you want natural resources that are not privately owned to be declared national property? In other words, common property. And the overwhelming response to that question, 81% of those voting supported the commons proposal. That story literally received no corporate coverage as far as we could track when we searched for coverage. The corporate media did cover the April 2013 results of an election that basically put back into power the very parties and the very leaders who were in charge of Iceland when the country experienced its massive financial crash of 2008. So I think a story like the people of Iceland voting to have their constitution reflect the commons, that doesn't get attention here because it runs contrary to fundamental kind of political ideology, political and economic ideology of the United States and of the corporate entities that run, 98% of the media in the United States. Part of what we saw in Iceland in 2012 and early 2013 was a kind of very effective melding of ballot box reform with organized street protests. And in the U.S., that always gets portrayed as an either-or alternative. You either do one or the other, right? Occupy with street protests, but refuse to go to the ballot, or ballot box people are, you know, voting advocates are afraid of organizing for the street. And what we saw in Iceland was those strategies go hand in hand.
Andy Lee Roth is Associate Director of Project Censored and co-editor of this year's edition, Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. Andy Lee Roth, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Well, the Center for Research on Globalization has been a major archive for news and reports that don't make the mainstream or even a lot of the alternative press. So to hear to talk about some of the major stories and developments of 2013 that are not getting enough attention is Michelle Chosadovsky. Michelle Chosadovsky is, of course, an award-winning author, emeritus professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Thank you for joining us, Professor Chosadovsky.
Delighted to be on the program.
Well, what's the, as you look at the last 12 months, the top story that comes to mind is something that's not getting adequate attention?
Well, there are stories which get attention, but the media manages to turn realities upside down. And we have covered extensively those types of stories. What strikes me is the coverage of the Syrian war, particularly in the last few months of 2013, when the mainstream media in chorus accuses the government of having used chemical weapons against his own people, when all the evidence suggests and confirms that the chemical weapons attack of August 21 was conducted by Al-Qaeda-affiliated rebels, and moreover, these Al-Qaeda-affiliated rebels were supported directly or indirectly by the United States. When I say indirectly, it was through Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia primarily. And we know that this is the case. And we know also that under international law, if you hire killers to go in and kill, you are liable for prosecution under all the various conventions that govern war crimes. And we're dealing with an invasion and not a civil war. I think that was one of the key concepts which has characterized 2013, and I think people are increasingly realizing that it is not a civil war, it is an invasion.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that another story theme that has been portrayed prominently on Global Research is the Fukushima disaster. You have an entire iBook dedicated to it. And I know that it's by far the most popular story that I've posted to your site has been the story we did on the Fukushima cover-up. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you see as being significant about that event?
Well, Fukushima coverage has been extensive, both in the independent media as well as in the corporate media. But at the same time, there's a subtle cover-up. It's not something which emerges in 2013. The online reader that we prepared dates back to January 2012, in other words, 2 years ago. And what we knew really at the outset of the crisis is now sort of surfacing. We knew that the food chain in Japan had been contaminated, but much more seriously, there were other concurrent events that even building materials were contaminated because they came from a plant which was close to Fukushima. We now can confirm that wildlife is contaminated in the northern Pacific region. TEPCO, the electricity company of Japan, has dumped plutonium radioactive waste into the Pacific Ocean. There's camouflage of the cleanup operations. of the role of organized crime and the contracts which are granted by big construction companies. We're dealing with a global crisis, a process of worldwide nuclear radiation, a nuclear war without a war.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the whole topic of globalization? I know that's a huge sector, but we have the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CETA. What are some of the main developments around this whole globalization of the economy and where things are moving forward?
Well, I think that's also probably one of the major themes which has characterized the global economy. It's the extension of what emerged, you know, in the late 90s or the mid-90s with the World Trade Organization and the various trade agreements to really encompass practically the entire world. There's a trade agreement negotiated between the United States and the European Union. There's another trade agreement negotiated with between Canada and the European Union, and then there's a trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which essentially encompasses a number of countries in the Asia-Pacific region. So that what is unfolding is a global area of U.S. Of Anglo-American dominance throughout the world, because these trade agreements, they're not really trade agreements at all. They pertain to intellectual property. They pertain to fiscal policy. The fact that companies can come in into a country and set up a private university and start asking for subsidies from the state. So it really is an encroachment on sovereignty which is occurring, and these trade agreements are looked upon somewhat separately. You know, you look at the TTP and its logic, then you look at the Canadian project, but you don't necessarily look at the process of integration which takes place when all these agreements are implemented simultaneously, in effect, as part of the same agenda. And what is disturbing, of course, is the fact that they're negotiated behind closed doors. They're secret agreements. Nobody knows about them. And mind you, that is a little bit the logic of the WTO, which was signed in 1995. Well, it was signed in late 1994 by officials and negotiators. And it was not even known to members of parliament or even, in some cases, heads of state and heads of government. And it was essentially some form of, well, you can talk about world government, but this world government really bypasses, in essence, bypasses all the institutions of the national state. And so we're dealing with essentially a process of building an empire through the imposition of so-called trade agreements. And as I said, it's not trade which is at stake. It's investment, it's ownership, it's macroeconomic policy, it's social policy, which is built into the clauses of these trade deals.
Professor Chostadovsky, one more theme would be the whole issue of the U.S.-NATO war agenda. As you mentioned, There was a lead up to what was supposed to be an invasion of Syria, which didn't pan out, or apparently did. It was either canceled or postponed. There's the U.S.-China pivot. What has 2013 told us about what U.S.-NATO, the U.S.-NATO war agenda, and what's on the horizon?
Well, I think that what we have witnessed in 2013 is a global military agenda, namely, modes of intervention, not necessarily theater wars, are being implemented in all major regions of the world. What is at stake in Africa is a process of destabilization of the nation state. It's literally destroying country after country. And we're not talking about one or two countries. We're talking about the whole belt of Central Africa, from Ivory Coast right to Somalia. And all this is presented through the corporate media as being part of humanitarian endeavors, interventions which are required to safeguard the interests of governments and so on, or come to the rescue of civilians, when in fact these are mechanisms which destabilize countries and allow for greater access of Western capital to resources. But I should mention that what is at stake also is the confrontation between the Western military alliance on the one hand, in other words, the United States, NATO, Israel, and the alliance between China and Russia. This is particularly true in the Middle East, and certainly China and Russia played an important role in Syria. But if you look in the Far East, you can see that there's also a confrontation, and the confrontation is the United States, Japan, South Korea, which constitute a formidable military bloc, and they're not part of NATO per se. They have links to NATO. And, of course, China, and that's the whole basis of the Asian pivot. I should mention also, of course, Australia, which is also an important military actor. So that you have processes of militarization in the Far East and Southeast Asia. On the one hand, you have the sending in of special forces, you know, intelligence operatives into Africa, triggering civil wars. But essentially, the background is one of building a global empire. And I think what troubles me in particular is the fact that this agenda is not the object of any kind of anti-war activism. And in fact, exactly the opposite, that many people in the anti-war movement now, in a sense, aligning themselves with the responsibility to protect humanitarian mandate. They will say, we are against the war, but we support the war on terrorism, without understanding that the war on terrorism is a mechanism of destabilizing countries. And this is true particularly it was true in Libya, and it's also true in Syria, where so-called progressives will pay lip service to the so-called opposition or opposition forces in Syria, without understanding that these opposition forces are largely integrated by death squads who are trained. They're trained in Saudi Arabia and Qatar. They're financed directly by NATO countries, including the United States, Turkey. And they are sent in with the mandate to kill civilians and create atrocities, which are then blamed on the Syrian government. It's a diabolical process of going in, killing people, and then using the mass casualty events and civilian deaths as a pretext to intervene on humanitarian grounds.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, Professor Chostadovsky. I want to thank you very much for those insights, as well as your ongoing analysis of you and your various authors and contributors to the Global Research website. Thank you so much for sharing them with us, and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
And we've been speaking with Professor Michel Chostadovsky, who is the President and Director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and is an Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa. You can find his writings at globalresearch.ca.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour and our special look at the most underreported and important stories of 2013. If you'd like more details about the topics covered on this program, please visit intercontinentalcry.org, projectcensored.org, and globalresearch.ca. And please consider donating generously to these and other independent media outlets, including your local community radio station. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.